The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
The prospect of caring for a family member at home who has serious health issues would be a daunting challenge for any of us. But imagine being a teenager, or even younger, and faced with the daily responsibility of taking care of a parent or other family member with a major medical problem. Amazingly, more than 1 million kids in this country are in just that situation. On this edition of UWM Today, we introduce you to Melinda Cavanaugh, assistant professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, who's done extensive research on this topic. Melinda, welcome. It's hard to believe. I mean, that kids, you know, as young, I guess, as even 8, 9 years old, find themselves in the situation of taking care of someone with serious issues.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Tom. It is something that is constantly surprising folks whenever I talk to people about the work that I do, whether when I was a social worker in practice or now as a researcher and teacher at the university. People are always constantly surprised. I remember working on my prelims and dissertation, which I conducted on young caregivers, and someone at the university where I was just couldn't wrap their minds around it. And it took several meetings as a national caregiving expert to recognize, oh, wait, we're talking about young children.
How does it happen? And what sort of situations present themselves where you have these young kids with all of this responsibility?
Wow, that's a really broad question. You know, it happens in a lot of different contexts. It happens in families who have a physical disability. So my area of expertise and research has been on neurological disorders. So I've studied kids and families who have Huntington's disease, which is a genetic neurological disorder where it creates not only physical limitations and impairments, it creates extra movements, it creates cognitive impairment, personality change, executive function impairment. So you have a very complex array of symptoms and issues that the family as a whole are dealing with. Other diseases as well that I work with, ALS, you know, people who have a very quick progression but have, again, a very broad constellation of symptoms. So the fact that families are the primary caregivers, informal caregivers in the U.S., it shouldn't be that surprising that children are involved. They're often in the home, particularly in diseases that affect individuals at a younger age, where, you know, they're kind of at the prime of life, if you will. And who is in the home but often a child? And so it's complex. It is caring for parents or family members who have physical illness. We also have a lot of kids who help out family members who have substance abuse issues or mental health issues. It's not just a physical limitation or a physical disability. It really crosses over a variety of different boundaries and issues.
You know, for those of us who have health insurance and you know, working for the university, we're blessed with having good health insurance. For some of us, I guess we just can presume that everybody's in that situation where you have that cavalry that can come in. You've got this outside support network that would go ahead and be there, but not always the case if you don't have the kind of support system that middle class or more affluent people may have.
Well, you bring up some issues of kind of informal supports and formal supports. You know, the idea of informal supports, whether it's your family, whether it's your community, you know, that certainly crosses over all socioeconomic status. And so we certainly do look to that in a variety of different ways. But the idea of a formal support in terms of insurance, in terms of long-term care, in terms of home health, you know, absolutely, these are tied up in, you know, can you afford these kinds of programs? Can you afford to pay premiums? Does it come with your job? Are you a part of, you know, have you signed up through the Affordable Care Act? But even in the presence of health insurance, those things don't cover daily caregiving in all aspects, and they certainly don't cover the cost to have a child be a caregiver. So, you know, we look at families who may have private insurance, but if you need someone to kind of stay and watch out for you during the day, to make sure you don't wander off, to make sure that you don't harm yourself during the day for whatever reason, insurance companies don't provide someone to just come and sit there and hang out with you. So that's often a job that family members take on. And if the other family members in the home, the adults in the home, say, are trying to work 2, 3, 4 jobs to either maintain that insurance coverage or just maintain the home, who is left? And, you know, one thing that I found in a lot of my research is that if someone is disabled, quote unquote, they are on disability, they don't have access to Medicare until they have to wait a 2-year, 24-month period before they have access to Medicare if they're under the age of 65. So I had a lot in my clinical practice. I had families who ran into this, who had to go on disability because of their disorder, and then they couldn't have health insurance until they qualified for Medicare after this 2-year wait. And for someone who has a chronic disabling disability, a 2-year wait with no health insurance can be devastating. You know, the other family member may be trying desperately to just maintain the home and maintain their health insurance, but if they aren't able to put that person on their health insurance, you have a real trauma for the families, if you will, and that's often where these young kids come in.
So by default, it's all hands on deck. The kids are pulled in, and they have to help out. So the big question is, what impact does this have on the lives of these young kids? I mean, you know it in your research, you see children as young as 8, 9, mm-hmm. 10 years old mm-hmm. being given this heavy, heavy burden to carry. The result or the impact on these kids?
You know, it's broad. these kids really, they experience both positive and negative outcomes of caregiving. So some of the things that both myself and others who really study these young carers here in the U.S. have found that one of the biggest impacts is on their school performance and attendance. And this is an issue that is of extreme importance given the primacy of education in, you know, our youth in this country and elsewhere. And so kids who are providing care are late to school. They aren't able to do their homework because their caregiving duties really absorbed the entire evening. They are maybe not participating in school activities. When I was a clinical social worker and really was starting to grasp this understanding of young caregivers, I had kids come up to me and say, you know, Melinda, I can't play soccer anymore, or I can't, you know, go do this with my friends anymore, and I can't do that anymore because I'm learning how to, you know, tube feed my dad. I have to stay at home and take care of him. I have to do all of these things at the home. And it really limits the kind of childhood experience, if you will. And not only is it that it limits the broad childhood experience, it limits their school activities. It limits their ability to stay awake in school. Many of them are up all evening. I'm doing a study right now with the ALS Association of Wisconsin and recently interviewed a young man who is 12 years old and who was saying that he falls asleep frequently in school because he has to get up in the middle of the night and help his mom move his dad and help his dad go to the bathroom. And so, you know, he sees that as honestly, he sees that as a real badge of honor. He values that. He says he wants to be able to help his dad. But at the same time, he's conflicted because it does impact his ability to be a student. Another way that kids are impacted is with their peers. In my research with kids who care for a parent with Huntington's disease, one of the biggest things that they found, that I found through the qualitative portion of my research, was that they just don't have friends who get it. You know, they'll try to talk to their friends about it. But when you're 13, 14, 15, and really developmentally, you're not only looking for your own identity, but you're also looking for a sense of affiliation with those peers around you. And if they are not grasping what you're doing, then you often feel out of the norm. And you don't have someone to really confide in. So there's a sense of separation. There's a sense of lack of identification with your peers. And that really brings about a sense of emotional instability, whether it's anxiety, whether it's depression. You know, the psychological impact is there.
And it, you end up running the risk of having two wounded members of the family, the person with the disability and this young child who's been given this, mm-hmm. this incredible responsibility and may not have the emotional maturity to handle it like you or I. Although, as you describe, you know, some of these situations, I'm not sure many of us could handle that very well without going into some serious emotional challenges ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's about acknowledgement, first of all. Something that we do not do well here in the United States is simply acknowledge that these kids exist. So the statistic that you reported just a moment ago, a little over a million kids, approximately between 1.3 and 1.5 million kids in the U.S. are young caregivers. Now, these are kids between the ages of roughly 8 and 18. But that study was conducted almost 10 years ago, and that's the only large-scale prevalence study we have of young caregivers in the United States. Add to that really a handful of studies that have been done here and there, you know, give us a very small understanding of what's going on with young carers in the U.S. You compare that to other countries, particularly the United Kingdom, that has been doing extensive work around young caregiving for upwards of 20 years. And they have a Bill of Rights for young caregivers, that these young caregivers have the right to an assessment. They have the right for someone to come into the home and say, what's going on? How can we help you? What kind of services can we provide? What kinds of things can we help you with? What respite? You know, here in the U.S., we're so much behind even having the conversation of saying at the beginning, wow, I didn't even know these kids existed.
They're invisible. I mean, yes. When I began doing research for the program and mm-hmm. read on your work, I actually had to reread it. I said, this can't be right. You know, yeah. a million and a half mm-hmm. kids. And now you say that statistic is, what, 10 years old? It could be worse given the economic downturn mm-hmm. that we've been through in the last 10 years. Why are they invisible? I mean, whose fault is it that these kids have fallen through the cracks?
You know, I get asked that a lot. I think it's an awfully complex question that doesn't have a real definitive answer. I think some of it has to do with just we as a society, when we think about who's a caregiver, right? We spend a tremendous amount of attention and energy, as we should, on the adult caregivers. We have coined phrases, you know, such as the sandwich generation, people who are in their maybe 40s and 50s who are raising their own children and yet at the same time providing care to an elder. So we have a huge generation of individuals who are really trying to balance that caregiving. You know, with the size of our baby boomer generation, exponentially going to be in need of long-term care, support services. You know, we tend to pay attention to the upper end of the spectrum, if you will, in the age of caregiving and those who need care. So I think a lot of it has to do do with – that's just how we've conceptualized caregiving in our society.
And there are more people in that age group.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that said, you know, something that I have found in my research with the kids who are caring for a family member with ALS, because ALS frequently does happen at a little bit of an older age – I have come across quite a few kids who are doing extensive caregiving for a grandparent. So simply because we have this large portion of our population that is aging, that is coming into needing more care, that does not mean that their caregivers aren't 8, 10, and 12, and 15 years old. And so I think some of it is just being willing to broaden the scope of what is caregiving. Understand that caregiving is just bigger than what we think it is. I think that's at its core what it is. And I think sometimes people just don't want to think of a kid doing some of the things that they do. And, you know, I want to be really clear. There are certainly positive aspects. And kids really do feel a sense of pride, a sense of, positiveness that they are helping out a loved one, that they're, you know, taking care of grandma. That makes them feel good about themselves.
They're grown up. I mean, yes. maybe a little too fast, but you know, what kid doesn't want to feel grown up, right? But boy, to be thrust into this situation where it's not that you necessarily asked for it, but it is on you.
It's a double-edged sword.
Big
because
burden.
Kids say, you know, I've interviewed around 60 kids who are caregivers right now, and you know, they say things like, I wish I didn't have to grow up so fast. You know, I would have liked to have been the kid, like the kid down the street who's just goofing off and doing teenager stuff instead of being home and being, you know, really responsible at a very young age. At the same time, they say, but yet I'm responsible and I have a sense of the world, you know, that maybe some of my other peers just don't have, that are kind of goofing off all the time.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio, Melinda Cavanaugh. Melinda is an assistant professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM, and we're talking about some amazing research that she's done looking at the challenges of being a young caregiver, kids as young as 8, 9, 10 years old, providing a significant amount of care to a loved one in the home, and what that means both for the child and I guess for the caregiver. Let's talk for just a moment, Melinda, about the receiver of this care, the mom, the dad, the grandma, as you point out, and any sense of how they view this situation, knowing that their young child or teenager is giving a whole heck of a lot up to take care of them?
Mm-hmm. That's a really important question to ask. And something that we don't have a tremendous amount of information on. What we do know is that, you know, there's definitely a sense of, I need some help, and it's great to have someone help me, and I am happy to have that help, but I also do understand the need for the child to try to find that balance. As a social worker in my practice, I used to really talk with the families about, you know, how are you doing with this as well? And the parents would, you know, they would never say, well, you know, I'm not parenting my kid. I'm still parenting my child. I just need some assistance. Right. And there's some work that's been done in the United Kingdom around this where some folks have interviewed parents who have a child as a caregiver. And they say much the same thing, that it's not that I am abdicating my role as a parent and that my child is now in that parent role and they are now parenting me. They're providing care to me. And sometimes it can be seen as a little bit of a fine line because, you know, there has been research in the years past around theories of parentification and, you know, really kind of based in family therapy and family theory around a child who really then goes in and assumes the parental role in the family. Often that's constructed around issues of substance abuse and severe mental illness. But These kids can be somewhat parentified, but they're not all parentified. And that's something that we need to be very careful of and really kind of analyze and research further, in that there is a difference between a child who's just helping out a parent, who's still the parent and wants to be the parent, but who just can't do everything on their own, versus a parent who says, you know, for whatever reason, I'm out.
And you're in charge.
And you parent me, and you parent everybody. You know, so there are nuances, and there's some wonderful research coming out of Canada, really looking at this kind of thing. And so, you know, it's questions that need to continue to be asked that we don't have a lot of real detail around.
As I was looking at your work, I reading one of the stories about people you've come across. I saw you describe a young girl who was taken to task in school because she kept falling asleep, and she was sort of called out by the teacher as being a slacker, but that wasn't the case at all.
Not at all. I'll never forget that interview, and she was a really extraordinarily intelligent, lovely young woman whose dad was having some very severe issues with his disease. And she was falling asleep in school because she was up till 2, 3 in the morning because her mother was working overnight and extra hours to try to maintain the household. And she was falling asleep in school. And the teacher slammed the book on her desk and said, you know, get up. And not trying to demean the teacher, because I can have a sense that, you know, there is some amount of frustration when students fall asleep in your class. At the same time, it's about what you do in follow-up. And what didn't happen was, why are you falling asleep? What's going on? How can I hear you? How can I help provide support for you? What areas can I direct you to? But it was just, wake up. You are falling asleep and you're some sort of slacker. And this young woman that I interviewed was terribly affected by that and said, I felt so horrible about myself and I just wish she had asked me. And as the student, you know, we have to understand there, you know, there's issues of power. There's issues of, can I call my teacher out? She didn't feel comfortable doing that, but she got called out.
But here again, a great example of how invisible these young kids are, taking care of a loved one, putting so much of their life on hold, and in many cases, people not appreciating the situation that they're in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What can we do? What can we do to lighten the burden on these kids? I mean, I'm frankly appalled as I think about the fact that in this community there have to be hundreds or thousands of kids who are to some degree carrying a much, much heavier weight than perhaps they ever should have to.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's important what we're doing now, just even talking about it, bringing awareness. One of the things that is incredibly important is for schools to be involved, because that's, first of all, where kids spend the majority of their days. But second of all, that's where we see a lot of clear impacts of caregiving. So making, you know, caregiver-friendly schools, providing education to the staff. Here in the United States, we have one organization, the American Association of Caregiving Youth. It's based out of Florida, and they do provide school-based education and pamphlets and information. You know, right now they're, you know, they are starting to extend their reach. But if you think about how large the United States is, to have one organization in Florida is really shameful, quite frankly. And so what we can do is talk to the people in your community, talk to the people in your schools, ask about the kids. What does the school social worker know? What do the school nurses know? I'd be willing to bet that they have a little bit of a sense. They're just not sure broadly what's going on with these kids.
What if you live next door or in the neighborhood to a family where you know that there's someone with some serious issues and there are kids in the home? Is it appropriate to knock on the door and say, hey, you know, how you doing? Or see whether you can help out a little bit, spot the kids some free time?
I think that's a lovely idea. You know, so much of of our world, we tend to be a little isolationist for a variety of different reasons. We're all very busy. We're doing lots of things. We have lots of technology that, you know, commands our attention. We have kids of our own. We have families of our own. But being able to step outside that and say, now, wait a minute, my neighbor has three kids and a debilitating disease. What can I do? Can I just, like you said, spot them a few minutes? Can I come by and offer my time? In my research, what I found was that the kids weren't always saying, I don't want to do this. I just need someone to help me do it. So rather than saying, oh, I'm really sorry that you're a caregiver, say, what can I do to help? Can I be here for an hour? Can I drive your mom to the store? Can I take out your trash? Just simple things to help the person out, but it serves to form community as well. The last area that I think is really important and an area that I tend to work mostly in is with disease-specific organizations. So working with the ALS Association of Wisconsin, who has been extraordinary in embracing this idea of, wait a minute, what's going on with kids? They'd never acknowledged it because, again, it's just not something that comes to people's minds.
Out of sight.
But if you think about it, where do we find young caregivers? We go through the person who has the disease or the disorder, and then we say, who's caring for you? And so engaging disease-specific organizations to help them develop support groups, intervention programs, do research to see what's going on, what are some of the issues, and how can they, because they know the disease better than anybody, how can they provide programs and services for the kid and the family as a whole to really relieve the burden across the family.
And maybe a church, synagogue, maybe getting them to just do a quick inventory and say, hey, is there anybody there who needs some help?
Absolutely. It's awareness. It's awareness. Not like so many things. It's just about awareness and acknowledging and talking to people about it, not just keeping it hidden.
Just a minute left before we wrap up here, but are you hopeful? Do you think that the message is going to get through, that we need to pay attention to this?
I am. I'm very hopeful. I'm very passionate about it. I've seen far too many of these kids and these families not to be, but I am hopeful, yes.
Well, we wish you continued success as you study this problem, bringing it to light. That's the beauty about so much of the research that we do at the university. It not only can help bring progress to the search for solutions, but in your case, just putting the spotlight on the problem is incredibly important for us to do. So thank you so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Melinda Cavanaugh, assistant professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare and the chief sponsor of a major look at the challenges of being a young caregiver in the home, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We will see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.